We're very fortunate today to be joined by TV Narendran, Global CEO and Managing Director of Tata Steel. Tata Steel is, of course, an iconic company in India, but over the last 30 years has also become an international player. So, a few words about Tata Steel today. Company over 100 years old, $33 billion revenues last year, 65,000 employees, 10th largest steel producer in the world with about 30 million tons produced. Overall, operating in 26 countries with two-thirds of production in India, a little bit in Southeast Asia, a little bit in the UK, and the rest mainly in the Netherlands. And we'll come back on this. Also, Tata Steel today is in the top five lowest cost producers in the world. The company has been winning many, many awards, including Great Place to Work sort of awards, and also a great many awards on the sustainability front. And again, we will come back on that too. Financially very successful under Narendran's tenure, including a stock price that has been multiplied by four since April 2020. Then on our guest today, TV Narendran, Global CEO and Managing Director, as I said, of Tata Steel since 2017. Before that, Narendran was named Managing Director of the Indian business in 2013, after about 25 years of climbing the ranks of the organization that he joined straight out of school after an engineering degree and an MBA at IIM Calcutta. Narendran is the past president, 2021-22, of the Confederation of Indian Industry. And individually, he too has been receiving a great many awards, celebrating the spectacular turnaround of Tata Steel under his leadership, including most recently the 2023 Outstanding Business Leader of the Year Award and several Best CEO Awards in various categories. Now, that's a lot of information, but hopefully enough to convince our viewers to stay tuned and to benefit from your insights, Narendran. Again, a warm welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean-François. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So now, before we get to Tata Steel's past, present, and future, maybe two quick questions. The first one on ownership. Tata Steel is a listed company, and it is also a part of the Tata Group. Could you tell us briefly, first about the Tata Group and the place of Tata Steel therein?
The Tata Group is special and different because of the way it's structured. Tata Sons is the holding company of Tata Group. It is unlisted, but 66% owned by Tata Trusts. And Tata Sons owns 33% of Tata Steel. The balance, 67%, is owned by retail shareholders. We have more than 3 million retail shareholders plus institutional investors. And what is unique about the Tata Group is the trusts spend all the money that they get in social work and charity work. Hence, there's a great deal of respect for the group because the money which is made and goes back to the shareholders or the parent in terms of dividends gets spent in society. And that's why the group has a lot of credibility, at least in India, where we built this rich history over the last 100 years. We are relatively new overseas. We've been operating overseas for many years, but we are now significantly overseas maybe for the last 20, 30 years, and obviously are still building our reputations and credentials worldwide.
The second question before we get to Tata Steel, I think we must immediately address, is the issue of sustainability and climate change. The steel industry represents, give or take, 7 to 10% of the world's CO2 footprint. And so it is clearly part of the quote-unquote environmental problem. And yet at the same time, steel is also a very effective and efficient material for humanity. So please tell us why steel is quote-unquote worth the environmental impact.
Yeah. You know, steel, like you said, is pretty much an essential part of our daily lives. I think all of us in our day-to-day lives encounter steel directly or indirectly in some form or the other, because it's the most commonly used metal. There's 35 to 40 times more steel used than aluminium, which is the next commonly used metal. And the reason is not just the versatility of steel and the durability of steel, but also the fact that steel is great value for money. So typically, aluminium costs 3 to 4 times as much as steel. All other, if you look at copper, if you look at most other metals, they are far more expensive than steel. So that's why steel is found everywhere, whether you look at construction, you look at automobiles, you look at appliances, and if not anything else, you will see that most machinery that you use to make anything is made out of steel. So it's a $1 trillion industry. The world produces about 1.8 billion tons of steel, is expected to produce about 2.5 billion tons of steel over the next few decades as India and Africa develop, and you have billions of people moving from living in underdeveloped countries to developed countries. So it's an essential part of development. It's an essential part of infrastructure. It's an essential part of consumption. But having said that, as you described, you make a ton of steel, you typically emit 2 tons of carbon. Again, it is much less than what you emit for most other metals. But because of the size of the industry, it accounts for 8% of the carbon emission in the world. So that's why it's seen as a hard-to-abate sector, an important sector which needs to be part of the climate change solution. So it's an important challenge, but I think that's what all of us in the steel industry and Tata Steel are dealing with.
And we're coming back to it. In fact, maybe just to close the point for now, you and Tata Steel have committed to be carbon neutral by 2045, which, as I understand it, is the earliest commitment among major steel producers. Is that right?
That's correct. Most steel companies, the large ones, have basically committed net zero by 2050. We have committed 2045 to take on the challenge for ourselves. The solutions are there. The solutions need to be scaled up. And there would be different solutions for different geographies. In Europe, we are well underway in this transition, both in UK and Netherlands. It also helps that the policy framework in Europe is encouraging us to make this shift sooner than later, is incentivizing us to make this shift. In India, the policy framework is still evolving. We also need to make sure that the alternate inputs, because essentially when you convert steel to a green process route, you're going to substitute using of coal with using of some other reductant like hydrogen or gas. That means you need to have hydrogen or gas available. We are still some distance away from that in India. In Europe, there's a lot more progress towards that. So we are moving towards a net zero production base in Europe faster than in India, but we hope that over the next 20, 22 years, we'll be able to scale up the technologies to find those solutions for India as well.
Now, I've already said that Tata Steel has been very successful over the last few years, but this is clearly the result of a turnaround because following the global financial crisis, the company was in a difficult position.
I think if I were to describe it, what basically happened since 2008 is we restructured the European business. Our production in UK was 40% of our global production in 2008. India was just about 20-25% of the overall production. Over the last 10-15 years, more so inorganically over the last few years, we've grown the India production. Today, the India production is about 60% of our overall production. The UK business, which was the weakest of our businesses, has now shrunk to 10%. As a consequence, we are in a structurally much better place than we were then. The India business, which is very profitable, is the biggest part of our business. The Dutch business, which is reasonably good, is the second biggest part of our business. And the UK business, which was our weakest, is the smallest part of our business. Both in UK and Netherlands, as you described, we are in conversations with the governments. In UK, we've come to a conclusion as far as the conversation with the government is concerned. And governments in Europe are helping steel companies transition, just like they helped other industries, whether it's the renewables industry or the automotive industry, to transition.
Of course.
There are incentives that we seek because the cost of transition cannot be borne just by the industry. I'm not talking of Tata Steel, I'm talking of all steel companies. Right. Customers obviously have to be willing to pay more for green steel. Governments have to support us on CapEx and OpEx, and the steel companies themselves have to invest in this transition.
Now, you already mentioned that you've grown in India in part through acquisitions, I think in 2018, 2019, 2022. And indeed, as you mentioned today, India represents the lion's share of revenues and particularly even more of profits. I think you're also planning further expansion in India. The goal, I think, is to reach 40 million tons by
2030.
Okay.
So we have doubled in the last few years. We were 10 million tons in India. We become 20 in the last few years, mainly through inorganic growth. And the next few years, we want to double from 20 to 40, mainly through organic growth. So that's a plan for the next few years.
First question on this, the obvious one. Why this push in India?
Because India's a growing market. The steel consumption in India, for instance, this year has grown by 10%. It's the fastest growing large market in the world. It's already the second largest market in the world for steel. And the largest market in the world for steel is China, which is 8 times larger. So that kind of gives you a sense of the potential in India. India traditionally has had consumption-led growth. So the steel intensity of growth was not so great. But now India is shifting more and more to infrastructure and investment-led growth. Steel intensity of that growth is higher. So typically countries which have investment-led growth, like China was, has a steel consumption which grows at a faster than the GDP growth rate. Right. In India, traditionally, steel consumption has grown lower than the GDP growth rate. So if you see this year, the expectation is the GDP will grow at around 6.5%. Steel consumption is expected to grow at least 10%. So that's a space which is a good space to be in. We also have a very long value chain. We are not only a big steel company, we already do about 40 million tons of mining. So we are a very well integrated steel business in India, from mining coal and iron ore to making downstream products. So our value chain is long, which protects us against the cyclicality. The demand growth is there. Our competitive position is great. And this is a business which typically has an EBITDA margin of about 20% in bad years and 35% in good years. So ROIC is very good, 25% plus. So it's a strong cash flow business. So there's no reason why we shouldn't invest to grow in India.
With the right company at the right place at the right time.
Absolutely. We've been here for a long time, but this is the right time to grow.
Okay, so let's go back to 2017. You became global CEO and you launched Strategy 2025. I would like to focus for a few minutes on two initiatives that you launched then. One was called Shikhar 25, I think Peak 25. It was a continuous improvement drive that led to a score of projects in the organization. And I have read that about 98% of these projects involved less than $5 million in value. Yet cumulatively, they amounted to huge savings. So please tell us about this very successful initiative, what it involved and why it worked so well.
So, you know, we initiated this project because one of the reasons why the India business has been very strong is the fact that we are backward integrated, have our own mining, as I just mentioned. But by 2030, many of these mines are coming up for auction. They come up for renewals. And as per the current rules in India, they need to be put up for auction. So we are conscious that by 2030, our cost of input will be much higher than we've been used to for more than 100 years in India, because we'll have to bid for the mines that we need to own. So the Shikhar 25, Shikhar, as you said, is a peak. 25 signifies 25% EBITDA margin, even if we were to buy raw material at market prices. So while I said our EBITDA margins in India were traditionally 20 to 35%, that's partly because we were getting raw materials pretty much at cost because of our own mining operations. So we said, can we preserve that margin even if we have to buy raw materials in the market? And that was a good goal to have, because that would prepare us for the future, and also not, we would not be sitting on our haunches just because we are doing well just now. So that was the whole objective. Typically in these change programs, while top down we set the goals, bottom up we look for ideas. So there is a lot of work which is done on the shop floor in the different teams. We form these impact centers. There's a lot of ideation. Then we track these ideas. Some of them will need investments. We also make sure that they move quickly from ideation to completion of projects, so that it translates into the bottom line. And each and every part of Tata Steel is encouraged to have these impact centers, ideate and come back with thoughts. And there's a very strong review process. We also recognize and reward the impact centers which have done best. Even last week, I was in Jamshedpur recognizing and rewarding the most or the best performing impact center. So there's a lot of momentum which is built, because a lot of people in the organization are involved either at ideation or execution. And there's a lot of recognition which goes on for good work which is being done. So I think that was what it was. And it coincided with a digital transformation journey that we were also running with. And you know, no better time than that, because you had COVID in between, which put a lot of pressure on our industry and on everyone else. So we were better prepared to deal with the challenges of that period. And I'm happy to say that this journey continues to pick up momentum.
So I'll come back on the digital transformation in a minute, but if you allow me to come back on Peak 25. So I was very fortunate in 1993 to come to Jamshedpur and to visit the operation. And I remember this as a relatively massive thing. And so when I think of continuous improvement teams, you know, I can see that in you know, in kind of small factories sort of thing. But this is gigantic. And what I'm hearing from you is, even in enormously capital intensive and with enormous machines, it is still possible for teams to sit down and to identify ways to improve the process and to create savings.
Absolutely. Because there's always in any process, there's always a bottleneck. The challenge is to find where the bottleneck is and what is constraining the process and to work on that. And then once you work on that, something else becomes a bottleneck. So it's a ongoing journey, it never ends. And currently, and I link it to digital transformation, because there's an enormous amount of data which is generated, but we only capture a fraction of it. And we only analyze a fraction of what we capture. So even that started changing. So that gives you more insights onto the numbers, helps you focus more on the areas that there is opportunity for improvement. So what you saw in the 90s was also hugely important. That was the beginning of what we call our TQM journey. Tata Steel at that time was not a very productive company. And Dr. Irani, who was the then CEO, drove a program like this on improving productivity. And by the end of the decade, we became one of the lowest cost producers of steel in the world of that decade, in the 90s. So I think there is a culture in Tata Steel of taking on challenging goals, involving everyone in this transformation program so that everyone feels they have a stake in it, and then running with it. And I think that's one of the special parts of the Tata Steel culture.
Now, you mentioned the digital transformation. Clearly there, as I was preparing for this discussion, I could identify a few key elements that made it successful. One is apparently you made a very senior external hire to lead the efforts. There were very significant investments. You were described in the articles I've read as a very strong champion of this digital transformation. There was a lot of education of the workforce throughout the organization. There were lots of teams involved. So tell us a little bit more what made the digital transformation successful, and successful relatively rapidly, because as you said, by 2020 and the COVID crisis, you were already significantly ahead. So what made this successful?
This journey started, I think, in 2015 or 16, when we started seeing what was happening in the world around us, particularly globally. And we knew that we had to embark on this journey. And in 2017, I think we got one of our senior colleagues from TCS, actually, Jayanto, who had a lot of experience with TCS, had seen the world, had worked with metals and mining companies. So I'd spoken to the chairman, Chandra, for a resource from outside, because I knew that if we were to drive this transformation in Tata Steel, we did need somebody who looked at it from the outside, who would work with us rather than somebody who'd grown up within Tata Steel. And so that's what Jayanto brought to the table. Before that, we had also started some of the work. We started a reverse mentoring program where we had all the senior leaders, including me, mentored by younger people, people below 30 years, who in some sense were digitally much savvier than us and helped us in this early part of the journey. Again, we set goals. We set a $2 billion cost takeout goal in the initial period. Again, a lot of ideation from people down the line. It was more about saying, how can we use technology to make life easier for people on the shop floor? How can we use technology to do better analytics, etc.? So we had a lot of ideas again from the shop floor, and how could we use technology to make their life easier? So I think it worked well, again, with a very structured process of having goals, ideation, seeing through the targets. We also spent a lot of money building the infrastructure, because we operate in some of the remotest parts of the country, right, particularly our mining operations. So we spent a lot of money in the initial period on making sure that the infrastructure was there, the connectivity was there. We also, kind of migrated to a cloud, which was one of the biggest migrations to cloud in India. So we did all this and we provided resources and, even small things like making sure the right people had the laptops and the iPads, in the organization. And as we did all this, COVID hit us, and we were one of those companies who could very quickly shift from work from your workplace to work from anywhere in most areas. And I think hence we also managed to deal with COVID very well. In fact, around that time, people were questioning, are we spending too much money on the IT infrastructure?
Right.
And after COVID, nobody ever questioned us on that. Right. So I think it was timely. And it happened fast. And I don't know if you're aware, but our plant in Netherlands, which is also a 100-year-old plant, and our plant in Jamshedpur, which is also a 100-year-old plant, have been recognized by the World Economic Forum as digital lighthouses. And the plant in Kalinganagar in India, which is one of our newest plants as well. So we are the only steel manufacturing company with three sites, which have been recognized as digital lighthouses by the World Economic Forum. So we are proud of that, but the journey still continues.
Now, another major initiative, part of that Strategy 2025, was the continuous shift toward higher value-added products, which I have read you quoted as saying that it kind of correlates with products that are hard to make. How difficult is that in your industry to shift the product mix?
Well, it calls for both. In some cases, it calls for investments. In some cases, it just calls for a different change of culture. Because two things happen. We continue to invest in growing our downstream businesses, which is about opening up new segments, making new investments, etc. But the other thing is we also invested in businesses like services and solutions, which is more about going deeper and deeper into the way steel is used by our customers and developing solutions so that more than selling a product, you're selling convenience, you're selling support, you're selling many other things. You know, you're packaging it in a manner that it becomes very difficult for your customer to move to some other supplier. So it's a strategy to engage very deeply in the way the product or this metal is used and to find solutions which can help us unlock value for the customer as well as unlock value for ourselves. So we're making good progress in all these areas. We also invested in a recycling business because traditionally we've been part of a linear value chain and we know that going forward we need to be part of a circular value chain. So we started investing in recycling. We believe recycling is going to be bigger than mining in the next 30, 40 years. So we've set up recycling units and we are also setting up steel making facilities using the recycled steel or recycled metal that we can capture.
As I'm hearing you describe these businesses, some of these have business models that are relatively dramatically different from your main business model. How easy is it to have different parts of the organization pursuing different business models?
It's not easy, but I think it can be done. You know, in some sense, the shift is, can we move more from capital-intensive businesses to knowledge-intensive businesses? Can we shift more from operations-intensive to customer-intensive, in some sense, right? So without forgetting what you're good at, how can we supplement with some of these shifts? So obviously, we've created new teams to work in these areas, typically younger teams with maybe less of a baggage of how the business needs to be run because they are relatively young and more eager to try out new things. So it, in some sense, it's like creating teams who are more entrepreneurial in a company which has been around for more than 100 years. You know, one of the five core values of the Tata Group is pioneering. And that's a value with which the group was started because we were the first in India in all these industries that we set up. So we wanted to get that pioneering instinct a bit back in Tata Steel. And some of these teams who were set to create these new businesses took it on as a challenge in that context.
I've seen organizations that are trying to do exactly what you just described, right? To say, let's create units where there's going to be a different way of doing things, more entrepreneurial. The organization very often creates antibodies against these foreign entities or these different entities. How much effort does it take from you and or from your top team to make sure that we're continuing to operate in a specialized way in each of these units as opposed to somehow, you know, developing one common model that would not fit anyone?
Yeah, so it's not been an easy journey. I think a lot of us had to put in a lot of effort, not least the passionate members of these teams. We've also had our own stumbles. We've made our own mistakes. So it's not been a perfect journey. We've had our own problems. But I think we've kept at it. What has also happened parallelly is 3 years back, we also said that we also need to make the mothership more agile. You know, okay. And so we started an agility program about 3-4 years back. And that is also about making Tata Steel more agile. You know, as we have these seeds that we have planted, which are growing and which are more entrepreneurial than the main parent. But we also said, how can we make the parent more agile and responsive? And that meant multiple things, a lot of programs, a lot of initiatives. We even had a team who are called bureaucracy busters, you know, who are looking for ideas on what is slowing people down internally in the organization. and how do we address that? Which are the processes which are slowing people down? Which are the functions which are slowing people down? And how do we address that? So we have a lot of work going on in those areas. We've also built in some of the qualities that we seek in leaders in terms of agility, in terms of responsiveness, in terms of people development, in terms of collaboration, in terms of accountability. So we've built that in into a 360-degree feedback that we take on all of them. In the first year, we did it for giving them a feedback. And we said from the second year, it's going to impact your bonuses and remuneration and your promotion opportunities and things like that. So it's very much part of the way a person is evaluated, whether that person is displaying the cultures that we require to be seen in the Tata Steel that we want to create of the future in an agile organization. So it calls for multiple interventions. It calls for setting those goals, building the capabilities, building it into our reward systems, at the end of it, people seeing the value in all this.
Now, this is part of Vision 2030, as I mentioned. And I think Vision 2030 incorporates a very exciting vision. Can we hear from you the Vision 2030?
Well, we have a vision which is even beyond 2030, which is to say that we want to be a global steel industry benchmark in value creation and corporate citizenship. This has been our overarching vision, which we've been running with, and many of the initiatives that we've been running with are in that. But we've, tried to give it a bit of a sharper focus. And we said that we want to be the most valuable and the respected steel company in the world by 2030. So that's not different from our overall vision, but it's a bit of a sharper focus on what we want to achieve. And that helps us focus some of the work that we're doing. And being the most respected means multiple things. So it also keeps us a bit on the toes, because it's being respected by peers, being respected by your customers, being respected by your stakeholders, all of them. So it kind of helps each part of the company push itself and ask itself, what is it that I need to do to be really respected? If I'm part of the R&D and technology team, am I doing stuff which is first in the world? I will only get respected if I'm doing stuff first in the world. If I'm in sustainability, am I setting goals which are better than anybody else in the steel industry? 2045, in some sense, is a reflection of that, right? So I think all parts of Tata Steel then start questioning themselves, what am I doing? And in my function, will I be the most respected if I achieve the goals that I've set myself? And if not, what are the goals I need to set myself? So these are the questions which we will end up asking ourselves when we set these goals.
You've mentioned customers, suppliers, employees, and so on. When I think of Tata Steel, and in fact, I happen to have written a case about this in 2004, Tata Steel for me was very much a company that was illustrating stakeholder capitalism as opposed to a hardcore shareholder capitalism. Do you see this stakeholder capitalism history and tradition as an asset for the company, or is it a liability? If we were more short-term focused, things would go better.
I think we've always seen it as an asset. All of us who work in the company, work in the group, have always seen it as an asset. Many outside have thought it's a liability till recently, but now everyone in the world is veering around towards this, right? So I think we've always said that the community is a very important part of the reason we exist. In fact, the founder, one of the most famous statements by the founder, Jayant Tata, is that the community is not just another stakeholder, but the very purpose of our existence, right? So if you take that seriously, then you will always do what is right for the community. And of course, not at the cost of other stakeholders, but finding that balance. Because oftentimes, we leave out the community when we think about, stakeholders, and we think of them last. So this gives us a social license to operate, because we operate in some of the poorest parts of India. And we've been operating there for more than 100 years. So it builds trust, it builds credibility, we get the credentials, we get the right kind of employees, we get the right kind of suppliers, our customers are happy to buy from us. And many of our shareholders, like our employees, are multi-generational. There are shareholders of Tata Steel, individual retail shareholders who held the shares for multiple generations, right? So you have that kind of, stated purpose, and you attract the right kind of stakeholders, whether it's investors or employees or suppliers. And you serve your customers and communities in the best way you can and take care of your employees.
Now, last question on the Vision 2030. One of the enablers is to foster a future-ready culture. Now, we recently conducted at IMD a CHRO roundtable on this very topic of future-ready organizations. So it's an important one, but what do you mean by a future-ready culture, and how does one go about fostering one?
You know, for us, future readiness consisted of three pillars. We said we should be structurally, financially, and culturally future-ready. Okay? The structural future-ready part is what I described earlier, growing the India business, transitioning the European business into a greener future, making sure that the UK business was restructured so that it's sustainable, so on and so forth. So that was about structurally dealing with it so that we are structurally future-ready. And the expectation is if we are structurally in the correct place, financially we would be fine because the cash flow generating parts of the business will become bigger and our balance sheet will become lighter, right? The cultural future readiness part is about saying that what are the elements of the culture of the past that we need to preserve?
Okay.
What are the elements do we need to strengthen? And what are the elements do we need to drop? And what are the elements of the culture of the future that we think we need to imbibe in ourselves? So it's about having a sense of all this and then driving the behavior, driving the programs, driving the way people are recognized and rewarded, communicating it so that people understand what is the culture we're looking for, and continuing on this journey and making role models of people who display those elements of the culture that we are seeking. It's also about making this organization ready for the future, you know, for the youngsters of today who are going to be your leaders of tomorrow. So it calls for change in multiple dimensions, even for that matter, inclusiveness. How do we make sure that we are a more diverse organization than we've been in the past? Traditionally, manufacturing, and that too in India, is very male dominated. So gender diversity, we're doing a lot of work with LGBTQIA, we're doing a lot of work with transgenders, you know, so multiple areas that we need to work on to really make ourselves an organization. Again, the digital journey, the agility journey, sustainability journey, these are all themes which are not only important for us, but resonate with the youth.
Now, as you may know, Naren, I'm a leadership professor, and that means I have to ask you a few more personal questions about you as a leader and also about your leadership journey before we close. Now, I've read a lot about you to prepare for this discussion. You're often described as calm, specific and balanced, polite and attentive, a very gentleman. But I'm old enough to know that one doesn't accomplish what you have accomplished over the last few years only by being polite and attentive. So the question that came to my mind is, are you what we used to call an iron hand in a velvet glove? How would you describe yourself?
I think you should ask my colleagues how they would describe me. But I think I'm very clear, you don't need to thump a table to achieve what you want to achieve. Right? I think it's as long as you're clear what you want to achieve, you're able to communicate that, you're able to pull people towards that, you're able to push people towards that. Some of the strongest leaders I've admired are Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi, and I don't think either of them thumped the table anywhere, anytime, but look at what they achieved.
So you still must have a steel resolve inside you.
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have survived in this industry, which is quite brutal. So yes, you need to be resilient. You need to demonstrate some of the qualities of the products that we make and have faith in the team. I think we have a fantastic team all along, not just now. I think we are blessed to have very passionate and committed employees who worked with us over 100 years in different sites. How do you find that balance between being proud of what you've achieved while at the same time not letting it slip into arrogance, being willing to continuously improve, accept that we can keep improving. So I think we have the right mix of people who are very passionate about the industry and the company. And I think oftentimes it's about giving clarity on what you want to achieve and making sure you get the best out of people. You know, and for that, people need to feel proud about what they're doing and should have the space and should feel that we are backing them and they're doing the right things.
You mentioned two of your role models, Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi. Both of them have been very explicit over the years that they had to work on themselves. I mean, Nelson Mandela early on was not the man that he was toward the end of his life. And the Mahatma was well known to have a period at the end of every day where he was looking back at the day, asking himself, what have I done well? What have I not done well? Were you always calm and measured, or have you worked at it? Are you still working at it?
Well, I think I don't know how, obviously I was not as calm as I am today as I was 30 years back. I think when I was younger, obviously, you know, one tends to be a bit more volatile. But I think largely, yeah, I think my temperament is a bit like this. But yes, I'm conscious also of the fact that I need to reflect. And I do reflect a lot on what has gone through the day, what has gone through the year. What do I need to do differently? Because that's how you help yourself. That's how you keep improving yourself. You learn from others. You learn from the people you watch, the people you observe. Not necessarily all people above you. There are lots of people who work for you. You can learn from, you know, it's from the books you read, experiences you have. So every day is an opportunity to learn. And you keep reflecting on what worked and what didn't work. Because oftentimes we take decisions or we handle situations wrongly. And you need to then get better at that. So I think I always look at myself as a student, you know, of leadership. I mean, you're a professor of leadership.
I'm also a student of leadership.
We are always students of leadership. I mean, even if you're a leader, you're a student of leadership.
Yeah. Are you making notes? Do you have a note-taking practice? Just curious.
Absolutely, I do. I write down a lot of things, sometimes just reflecting on, you know, a conversation I had or a meeting I've had. But I have, I used to have lots and lots of notebooks. Now I have a very busy iPad.
Right, of course. But I think that people, the reason I ask is I think this notion of journaling over the years has been a very powerful one for many people. And I think now, of course, we can have electronic journals, but I think the discipline of making notes is very helpful. Now, one of the interesting points that came up in a few of the articles that I read is the complementarity between you and your CFO, Mr. Kaushik Chatterjee. Apparently, at least in the articles I read, he was also in the running for the top job. But the two of you have been described as a very complementary and very, very effective pair. Please tell us about this complementarity, this partnership, and how it came about and how you're nurturing it.
You know, what is important is both Kaushik and I want to do what is good for the company, right? And then rest is about building a personal relationship and a chemistry and trusting each other, complimenting each other and what each of us is good at. And I think I look at sports team as great inspirations. I mean, there may be people who are very good at what they do, but they play together, work together for the good of the country or the club they represent. So for me, organizations are also like that. It's about, you may have a captain, you may have a CEO, but your team should all work. Everything should be subordinated to what is in the interest of the company, at least at the leadership level, irrespective of the egos that we may have or personal goals that we may have. When we are at work, we should subordinate everything to what is good for the company. And if you're all on the same page on that, then I don't think we'll have problems working with each other. We will have different views. It's good to have different views. But it's also good to have a culture where you can openly discuss these views, agree to disagree if required, but at the same time, keep moving forward in what is good for the company. So Kaushik is also a very mature guy, very capable person, and we've known each other for a very long time. So we have had no problems working with each other to do what is good for the company.
And now, next to last question, being the CEO of an organization as large, as complex as Tata Steel and as challenging as Tata Steel with also massive public exposure must be demanding. And I guess that maintaining yourself at peak performance all the time cannot be simple. Do you have some practices, some rituals that help you do this?
Yeah, I get up early every morning. I'm a morning person. Get up early, go for a run, go for a walk. I'm typically outdoors for an hour, hour and a half in the morning. That's, for me, the time when I get with myself. And, you know, that's my reflection time. And I'm ready for the day after that. Then the rest of the day is busy all the time. And when I get back in the evening, I relax. I listen to music. I like to read. I like to spend time with my family. I used to have dogs earlier. I used to love to spend time with them. So, you know, so I play the drums when I get the time. That's on weekends, if I can. So there are different ways to relax. You should have your own passions and, you know, find time for that because that helps you de-stress and relax. So I have my own routines to relax, yeah.
You make it sound relatively easy. You don't have stress issues.
Well, I don't think so. At least it doesn't seem like I have stress issues, but because I love my job, I love the company I work for, and I am a bit disciplined about my personal life in terms of how I spend my time.
And when you say disciplined about how you spend your time, may I ask, how does this discipline manifest itself?
Well, I, like I said, irrespective of where I am in the world, if I'm not on a plane, I get up early and go for a run or a walk. So I like physical activity. I used to play a lot of sports when I was young. So I've continued to be physically quite active. That's very important for me. I would feel a bit stressed if I've not stepped out anywhere in the morning. So, you know, so for me, that's a very important part of my day. And I think I've kept that discipline. It doesn't matter. I like to, if I can, sleep a bit early by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, but I get up by 4:35. So that gives me enough sleep and enough time for myself before I start my day.
Understood. And you've already started answering my last question. My last question is, you love your job because...
Well, I think it's a fantastic industry. There's something happening every day. It's a global industry. So people say, how have you spent 35 years in the same company or industry? I think every day I open the papers and there's something which impacts me. And very committed, passionate people. I work for a group which has a purpose larger than just making profits. Making profits is important, but there's a much larger purpose which, you know, so there's a congruence between what I think I want to do with my life and what the group and the company wants to do for society. So I think it helps put in that extra bit of work because, you know, it's for the right reason. So there's a bit of a balance there, and that helps you give in the best you can every day.
Darren, I want to thank you very much for your time, for your insights. The transformation you have led has been nothing short of exceptional. Obviously, as we said, steel is part of the problem, but it is also part of what humanity needs, especially in countries that haven't had the ability to use as much steel to organize society. So we wish you all the best continuing to lead the way among steel companies, both on the efficiency side and also on the sustainability side. Thank you for your time and all the best.
Thank you, Jean-François. Thank you very much for interviewing me. Thank you very much.